This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton, and our show is called Main Street because our microphones create a virtual Main Street all across North Dakota this time of day. The real Main Streets that are so important to our communities are places where we meet and greet each other, talk about what's on our mind, share our news and opinions. And today we're going to talk about how we talk with Kellum Barta. He is a PhD candidate and a graduate teaching assistant at the NDSU Department of English. He joins us in studio. Thanks for being here, Kellum.
Thanks for having me.
Let's get into this right away. This is called sociolinguistics.
Sociolinguistics, yes.
How did you get interested in the way people speak?
That's a great question. I think that when I was an undergraduate at NDSU, I discovered a course called Social and Regional Varieties of English, and I planned my whole semester around it. And once I started the formal study of language variation and the attitudes about language variation, I realized that I had been interested in it since I was a little kid, and I was in California, and my relatives down there heard me say pop and thought I was talking about my dad, and
instead
they called everything
soda.
Coke. Yeah.
Yeah.
And realized that I had had questions in my head kind of all my life. And so I would say since I was 8, but also since I started formal study in college.
Well, what can you learn by studying how someone speaks?
You can learn a lot about that person. So you can learn, I mean, on the surface, there's like where they're from. But you might also, perhaps more importantly, learn about what their motivations are for self-expression. So we use language to communicate, and maybe primarily, but we also use language to identify who we are. So when you hear someone pronounce something or use a certain word, you might understand then where they came from, but you might understand a little bit more about who they are and how they choose to express themselves as well.
So you can find out how much education they might have or that kind of thing?
Well, that's a tricky one because people tend to believe that there's like a one-to-one association with how much someone speaks the so-called standard version, which is a word I don't like. I prefer to refer to mainstream English or English is because there's more than one version. As much as we like to think there's this one version that everyone strives for, it's not really true.
It used to be referred to as standard American speech or broadcast speech.
Yeah. And broadcast is kind of where it comes from because there is some background to that is major broadcasters chose to gravitate towards speakers of certain dialects. And then because those voices were so widely heard, that became one of the standards for, oh, that's how we ought to talk.
And but maybe aspire to talk.
Sure.
But who does?
But there's a lot of other motivations for wanting to talk a certain way. And there are motivations for not wanting to talk like a mainstream sounding American as well.
You use the word dialect. What's the difference between accent and dialect?
Well, it depends on if you're talking to a linguist or a layperson. A lot of people will use those words interchangeably. Mm-hmm. I would call a dialect – I actually prefer the term variety. So I think of a dialect as a variety of English. There are a lot of different ways to speak or write, and a dialect is one of them, and everyone has one. The word dialect sometimes can be stigmatized and be used to sort of other a certain way of speaking. It's like, oh, that's not the mainstream. That's a dialect. If you say someone has an accent, that's kind of a substitute word for dialect. But if you ask a linguist, they're going to say accent means something a little more specific having to do with like a stress pattern. So saying like combat instead of combat is a stress difference. I would call that an accent.
Uh-huh. How did regional pronunciations come to be? I mean, we think of a southern dialect or a southwestern dialect or accent. But in North Dakota, you can drive 50 miles and somebody's going to sound different.
Yes. And in a city, you can go 50 blocks and somebody's going to sound different.
Sure.
And a lot of that has to do with isolation and geographical barriers. So with the settlement of America, before the widespread communication that we have today because of the internet, et cetera, if you lived on the other side of a river, your language, the way you spoke, tended to diverge from the people on the other side of that geographical boundary. And thus, you know, regional dialects happened. There's a second piece to that, especially when you talk about like Southern English, is that once those differences are sort of established, an identity is formed around them, and then people are more hesitant to change because their self-identity is encoded in the way they speak.
So these are my people. Yes, exactly. With them.
Yep. Okay. And the us or them categories, like you're not one of us or you're not from around here. I can tell by the way you talk.
Are regional differences evident in every spoken language?
Yeah. Yes.
And are they a way to identify with the people who live where you live? That sounds like this makes me comfortable to sound like my neighbors.
Yes, precisely.
We live in a country that was colonized by the English.
We do.
We speak that language.
Yes.
We don't sound English.
We do not. And so that goes to both those reasons I just talked about, the geographical barrier of the ocean, the isolation from English speakers with the colonial English, what eventually became American English speakers, and then the development of an American identity and the desire to sound not English because we don't want to be English.
Well, I've noticed actually that people who immigrate to this country from other countries, particularly from Europe, but when they learn English, they sound more American. It used to be when I was a younger kid, they all sounded English, like they learned what would have been standard English pronunciation as opposed to American.
Well, people who emigrate to America from other countries probably, if they already learned English, probably learned a British variety of English because that's what most of the world speaks because of the British Empire. The legacy of the British Empire is that world English sounds more like English or British English than it sounds like American English. Now, the degree to which in a second language English speaker sounds more like American English or English might have to do with the extent to which they're motivated to identify as American. It depends.
I've been struck. I was in Louisiana a few years back in the area where they have a lot of shrimpers, and a lot of them are Vietnamese. And you're seeing somebody who looks Vietnamese who is speaking with a southern accent.
Sure. And so, yeah, that would have to do with identity again. So if someone from Vietnam or a second-generation person whose parents were from Vietnam came to America and developed a southern accent, they were probably motivated to identify as a southerner, or perhaps it is a second-generation person who does identify more as southern American than Vietnamese American, and that's reflected in the way they talk.
We're talking with Kellen Barda. He's a PhD candidate and graduate teaching assistant at NDSU, and he'll be talking about this topic, why do people talk different? And it's tomorrow evening, Tuesday at 7 o'clock in Stoker's basement in the Hotel Donaldson in downtown Fargo. So give our listeners a sort of a taste of what you'll be talking about.
Well, this is a little bit of a taste. Another taste is that so you asked about sociolinguistics.
Yes.
So linguistics is the study of language. The socio part has to do with the attitudes people develop about variation in spoken, written language, particularly English is my specialty. And what you hear a lot from people these days is pointing out the way people talk as wrong. And that's kind of where I come in and say, well, what do you mean when you say wrong? And they'll say, well, it's not proper, it's not correct. And all those words are problematic to me because what I want to know is what's the source of that? And the answer sometimes is a dictionary or a rule book. But then I would ask, where do those books come from? And the answer is, well, those books came from listening to people talk and writing it down. And so it's circular logic. It's like the books are supposed to tell you how to speak, but really what they do is describe how people actually spoke, feed it back to you, and then subsequent, you know, generations read that and think, oh, this is the way to talk or to write. But it's always changing. Like you said, we don't sound like Shakespeare. If language didn't change, then we would, but we don't.
Mm. A while back, you spoke at TEDx Fargo, and one of the examples you offered to the audience was the correct pronunciation of the NDSU mascot.
Yep.
Which isn't bison.
Well, it depends on where you are. Again, it depends on your region, and it depends on your identity, and it depends on who you are associating with and how you want to come off to those people.
So it's a great example of what you're talking about.
Exactly. Yep. It's precisely why I studied it. So if you're from around here, Fargo, you're more likely to say bison with a z sound in the middle than bison with a s, like a snake in the middle. And that is tied up in our local identity. And the way I know that is I interviewed people from around the area, all the way west toward Bismarck, even in Canada, toward Minneapolis and in South Dakota. And once you get about 70 miles, 100 miles, give or take, away from Fargo, everybody says bison, sounding more like what you'd think of as an S sound, a sound. And it turns out the Z pronunciation, the bison, is local to us and unusual to everybody else in the country.
So if we keep saying it, and maybe in a generation it'll end up in a dictionary?
Yeah. I mean, sure. Yeah. So that's a good question. And I think the exposure of, say, like the NDSU football team may have already gotten that underway, because you hear over the 4 or 5 years of national broadcast, you started to hear the national broadcasters picking up on it. And occasionally they would talk about the idea that people around here feel very strongly about that as the correct pronunciation of bison. And you hear people saying things like, oh, say it right, it's bison. Or if you hear somebody say bison, you ought to punch them in the face. And maybe they didn't mean that literally, but people have very strong associations with what is correct. And it turns out that's tied up in our idea of identity as being, you know, from around here or tied to NDSU.
I've got two examples here of people moving to different parts of the country. In one case, it was an old friend of mine who moved to Louisiana. That's why I was down there. I was visiting him. And he had adapted this Louisiana patois. He sounded like he lived there, not like he was from Moorhead, Minnesota. My mother was born in Tennessee. She moved to Minnesota before I was born, and I'm past Social Security age now. She had that Mid-South accent her entire life, and she was the treat of all of my friends to come over and listen to her talk.
Yes, yes. It's a wonderful accent to listen to. And so my answer to that is that it's, again, motivation to express a certain identity. So
she was proud of being
from
there.
She was very proud of being from the South and from Tennessee, so she held on to her accent, whereas the other person who moved to Louisiana was probably more motivated to fit in down there and thus would – or even just had some kind of motivation to identify, maybe after living there for a while, identified more as from there as from where that person was originally and thus took on the features.
Now, given the instantaneous communications we have these days and the fact that we don't just live in a particular neighborhood or region all our lives mm-hmm. – our pronunciations are sort of starting to flatten out, aren't they? Aren't we starting to sound like each other?
Not really. I mean, there's for sure there are features of language that are spreading to people they normally wouldn't. But although one might intuitively expect to like lose dialects, research is showing the opposite, that dialects are still holding on strong and perhaps even increasing. And the motivation for that is perhaps that given this sort of unifying communication by the internet, people are even more motivated to hang on to those parts of themselves that they express through their language, and because they don't want to lose it, they're hanging on to it even more.
As a sociolinguist, what do you listen for? What changes really catch your ear?
Any of them? I like to listen for new words that come from young people.
Like dilly dilly?
Yeah, I mean, well, yes, that's a good example, sure.
Well, I just struck by that. There are also ways of speaking. Sometimes they're attached to given a sort of a gender identity. A vocal fry would be one of those, and you spoke about that at TEDx.
Yeah, Fargo. I did speak about vocal fry at TEDx.
Describe that to our listeners.
All right. Well, the only real good way to describe it is to try to do it, and I'm not always the best at producing these things, but I'll give it a shot. It's the sound that sounds like, oh, my God.
Oh, yeah.
So I studied this formally, which is to say I put voices into a computer and looked at the signal generated. And it's produced by irregular vibrating of the vocal folds, sort of very slow and irregular vibrating. And this entered pop culture in the last 5 years or so. And it was sort of young women that were singled out as doing it, and subsequently young women that were vilified for doing it. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that question has been answered completely yet, but in the studies that I conducted myself with Raleigh speakers, I didn't find a gender difference. And my sort of interpretation of that data was that, well, I think that young men and people in general are vocal frying. It's just that we're singling out women as a way of taking an already marginalized group and saying, hey, I don't like the way you talk, which is a pattern that sociolinguists have found for years with marginalized groups. And I talked about this at TEDx, but female speakers, African-American speakers, and even young people are just groups that we already marginalize as a society, and singling out the way they talk as, you know, wrong or second class is just a reflection. It's a that's a reflection of those ideas and values we already have.
Sort of that – is Valley Girl sort of under that heading as well?
Well, Valley Girl – so Valley Girl is a package. That's not – so Vocal Fry sort of got – tucked into a package of – and it, the post-Valley Girl version of it was probably the Kardashian speak. People would refer to it as that. But what they're referring to isn't just vocal fry. It also was something called high-rising intonation or uptalk was in that package where everything sounds like a question. Even if it's a statement, it sounds like a question because of that high-rising intonation. Mm-hmm. And so that plus vocal fry plus a couple other characteristics kind of got folded into a package. And people sort of blamed vocal fry for all of that. But it's its own feature. And even in some languages, vocal fry actually can change the meaning of a word. So even if you pronounce a word exactly the same in what we'd call modal voice, and then you pronounced it in vocal fry with every other feature of that pronunciation being the same, it would change meaning. So that is evidence that vocal fry is a valid linguistic feature that actually conveys meaning.
Sure.
Okay. In some languages.
So you're going to be speaking at the HODO in Stoker's Basement tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. Are you going to want to engage people in the practices they've heard or the questions they have about what they should understand about how people express themselves?
Absolutely. In fact, I encourage audience members to ask questions and as a big part of the presentation because I like to hear the differences in pronunciation, grammar, and what we call lexicon or vocabulary, word choice, that the audience is familiar with and talk about those rather than just bring in my own and say, here's what we're going to talk about today. And because I always get new ones too. There's new words, new grammatical structures, people hear that I haven't heard of yet. They heard it yesterday. They heard it on the internet, and I like to find out about that and try to see how they can fit into the patterns we've kind of seen with other variation and then discuss, like, what are the attitudes? What attitudes do you have? You know, where did those come from?
Because the language we use and the way we express ourselves is always changing.
Always changing, yes.
Kellen Barta is a PhD candidate and graduate teaching assistant at NDSU. He'll be speaking at the Hotel Donaldson in downtown Fargo at Stoker's Basement about sociolinguistics, and that's tomorrow evening at 7 o'clock. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you very much.
More Main Street in a moment.
Support for this program is provided by North Dakota Horizons, North Dakota's state magazine, showcasing North Dakota's quality of place, its abundant resources, and people. Learn more on Facebook and at ndhorizons.com. Hey kids, do you have a story to tell? Enter it in the 2018 PBS Kids Writers Contest. We're looking for amazing original stories from writers in kindergarten through the third grade. So tap into your imagination, break out the crayons and magic markers, and start writing today. When you enter, you'll have the chance to win and see your story published online. First place winners in each grade level will receive prizes and have their stories featured on the Prairie Public website. Everyone who submits a story gets a certificate of achievement. Find the rules and entry forms along with a writer's guide to help you brainstorm and develop plots at prairiepublic.org. Deadline to submit your original story is Friday, March 23rd. The 2018 PBS Kids Writers Contest. Enter today.
I'm Danielle Webster. North Dakota is kind of like one really big small town that's connected by really long streets. And we all really kind of know each other. I'm from Devil's Lake. I have family and friends that live all across the state in various different communities, small towns, metro areas. And everyone in North Dakota has connections like that. I mean, we always talk about 6 degrees of separation. I feel like it's a lot smaller in North Dakota. If something happens in Williston, that's our friends. Those are our neighbors over there that it's happening to. When it's flooding in Fargo, people in Devil's Lake understand what that's like. People in Minot know what that's like. There's a lot of really interesting things happening here all the time. There's a lot of water issues, energy issues, a lot of exciting things happening. There was a lot of growth and a lot of booming going on here. But there's also been a lot of struggle. You know, the oil industry obviously has been struggling now for the last year or two. Agriculture's been really kind of struggling. It's kind of like a roller coaster. I mean, people think North Dakota isn't that interesting or that not a lot of stuff happens here, but that is not really the case. We're all friends and neighbors and connected somehow, and working together to kind of get those stories out is a good thing. Listen for regional news on Prairie Public, telling North Dakota's story.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. What are the current circumstances of 573 tribal nations in the United States? Jefferson Keel, president of the National Congress of American Indians, delivered his State of the Indian Nations address today at the museum in Washington, D.C. And that's the subject of Trey Hatt Reports.
The State of the Union is a tradition in Washington. Its roots are in the Constitution as a presidential report to Congress. These days, Indian country is rarely mentioned in a formal State of the Union. But in July 1970, President Richard Nixon sent a special message to Congress on Indian affairs, announcing his policy on self-determination without termination. But that was a rare exception, and it was not the official State of the Union. So the National Congress of American Indians decided to deliver an annual message about tribal priorities for the Congress and for the administration. On February 12th, NCAI President Jefferson Keel called this an important moment. Our governments and our communities stand on high alert. He said the echoes of America's colonial past have continued to reverberate with disparaging rhetoric, failed policies, and a disregard for the inherent sovereignty of tribal nations. The recent tax legislation, for example, did not include Indian country. Keel said that tribal leaders met with members of Congress often. He said tribes offered thoughtful, pragmatic, deficit-neutral policy proposals. But the bill came together in a flurry, and when the dust settled, Indian country's top priorities were absent from the version the president signed in December, Keel said. That is completely unacceptable. There are two pending pieces of legislation that still wait for a tribal voice, the most recent farm bill and a plan for national infrastructure spending. Keel said, from wild rice and bison to salmon and blueberries, traditional native foods are not only our way of life, but an economic driver too. Indian agriculture is a $3.2 billion industry, supporting nearly 72,000 jobs in Indian country. So he added, no farm bill should pass unless it also listens to and strengthens Indian country's agricultural potential. Keel had a similar message on infrastructure, saying tribal infrastructure is American infrastructure. The country and Indian country are better off when there is a recognition of the historic tribal-federal relationship and when there is true partnership of consultation between tribes and the federal government. The State of Indian Nations is more than a tribal wish list. It's an opportunity for discourse about where Indian country stands in the American government and what the prospects are for improvement. This annual event draws members of Congress, the administration, and the public through a live broadcast. It's becoming an important voice, reminding the country what could be. President Keel's conclusion, as it has been for thousands of years, the State of Indian Nations is strong and everlasting. I'm Mark Trahant in Washington.
Mark Trahant is a professor of journalism at UND and the author of the Trahant Reports blog. You can read more of his work at trahantreports.com. That's T-R-A-H-A-N-T reports.com. Coming up on Main Street, the U.S. Olympic women's hockey team gets a strong start. First, the news with Danielle.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. More than 700 people are attending the governor's first ever Main Street North Dakota Summit being held in Bismarck. The conference is designed for community leaders to give them tools to make their cities vibrant so they can attract new people. Governor Doug Burgum has been a big proponent of this concept, he told reporters.
We're competing against every other state for 21st century talent, and it's not enough anymore just to have jobs available. We have to have communities available that people want to live in And that means we want our young people to stay. We want to be able to recruit families that want to grow here. And we've got to figure out a way to get some of the baby boomers to stick around longer. Because if every baby boomer, you know, decides their dream is to leave the state when they hit a certain era and get a house in a warmer climate, you know, that doesn't bode well, because we need baby boomers are an important part of our economy.
Burgum says baby boomers make up a significant number of doctors, nurses, and other professionals. The two-day conference runs through tomorrow. Secretary of State Al Jager says if he's reelected, he will push hard in the 2019 legislature for new voting machines. The current machines were purchased in 2004, funded through the Help America Vote Act. And Jager says those machines need to be replaced.
Some of the operating systems that we have are no longer supported with the equipment that was bought, back then. And so, something breaks or what have you, we're basically borrowing from one machine to make sure that the other machine works and stuff. So we have our fingers crossed that we'll be able to get through this election cycle, but the need is very much still there.
Jager asked the 2017 legislature for an appropriation for new machines, but was turned down. And the Social Detox Center in Grand Forks had more than 450 admissions in 2017. A year-end report suggests 140 different clients came through the doors of the Sober House during the first full year of operation. Director Curtis Scanson says he would expect those numbers to go up in 2018 and beyond.
You know, as the detox becomes more common and a more commonplace, I would anticipate those numbers to go up after each year. And even though we've been trying to get our name out there, I think there's still quite a few people in the community who don't know about us yet.
Scanson says increased admissions should not adversely impact the center's bottom line.
You know, one of the things that we have to remember with detox is it can be multiple admissions before change starts to happen or change starts to get into place. So we want to make sure that we offer services to people. Obviously, we want to make sure that they're not abusing the place, but we want to make sure that when they're ready to take that step for change that we're there and we're available to them.
The facility has 9 beds and operates on an annual budget of $350,000. It's a joint project of the city, county, Northeast Human Services, and All True Health. The facility opened in October of 2016. Health Director Debbie Swanson says the detox center fills an unfilled need in the community. Swanson says identifying sustainable funding past 2019 is a work in progress. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
You're listening to Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Doug Hamilton. Great things are expected from the U.S. Olympic women's hockey team. And in Sunday's first matchup in the preliminary rounds, Team USA defeated Finland 3-1.
The puck tied up deep in the finish zone, and now it's Lamoureux with a chance. A shot, we score! Team USA with a tie on the second effort.
That was the call from NBC Sports. One of Team USA's goals was scored by Monique Lamoureux-Mirando, an alumna of UND who starred for the Fighting Hawks before the women's hockey program was closed. Recently, Monique's twin sister Jocelyn talked with Todd Zwillick, host of Public Radio's The Takeaway, about the Olympics and the potential for women's hockey.
There's a small group of us, there's 6 of us, that this will be our third crack at it. And so I try to be a veteran on the team, but young at heart, just because the younger players bring a lot of youth and energy.
Veteran on the team, but young at heart. You're 28, right?
Yep.
The younger players see you as, great aunt. What is it like at 28?
It's as you kind of grow up through this program, I think our older players have continued to get older, but you just try and enjoy every single opportunity that you have to play with this team and to put on the Team USA jersey. But I think the younger players kind of look at a couple of us older players like grandmas. We go to bed early. We wake up early. We enjoy our morning coffees. But I think when we get in the locker room, we like to have our own fun.
Now, no one knows what's going to happen in the Olympic tournament, of course, but I think a lot of people are expecting a USA-Canada rematch, probably in the final. Team USA beat Canada in the World Cup last year, but over the last 6 meetings, it's Canada 5 wins, the USA just won. How much of Team USA's planning, conditioning, practice, off-ice planning is geared toward Team Canada?
I would say there's different drills that may be geared towards their style of play, but we definitely try to focus on ourselves, and we want people to adjust to our style and our game and our speed instead of the other way around. But we obviously understand that Canada, you know, and the history behind playing them and that they're a great team. And so we just have to be prepared to play our best game. And we feel confident that if we do that, we'll be successful.
Well, Jocelyn, let's go off the ice just for a minute, because you were on the show just about a year ago. And that was when Team USA threatened to boycott the World Cup to protest unfair wages. The team has a new contract now. I wonder how you're feeling about that, and also how the rest of the team is feeling having gone through that confrontation and come out the other end.
I think at times we almost didn't realize how monumental the spring was for us, our team, for women's sports, for gender equity. And so whenever it comes up, I think, you know, it's a good reminder to really, you know, feel proud about what we were able to accomplish. But on the day to day, I think we show up to the rink and, you know, we're prepared to go to work and get better every day. And it's a work in progress. We're able to accomplish a lot with a contract, but it's also continuing to implement those things that we asked for and make sure that we're continuing to move in a positive direction with USA Hockey and promote women's hockey and promote girls' hockey and try and grow the sport. And this year is an instrumental year in doing that. To get girls in front of world-class game is special, and it's, I remember when I was in, I think it was fifth grade, I went to the U.S. was playing the University of Minnesota in Grand Forks, North Dakota, and my mom took us to the game, and so those are opportunities that I remember having during Olympic seasons, and so it's definitely something that we have to remind ourselves that was pretty special, but it created a trust within our locker room that I don't think would be there any other way.
Well, the team negotiated hard for that, Jocelyn. I would imagine that a great Olympics on television in prime time across the United States would probably be one of the best things that you guys feel like you could do for the development of girls hockey.
The best thing our team can do for the development is to go win a gold medal. That's for sure. If we can do that, it'll definitely change drastically in this country as far as more eyes on the sport and more parents hopefully watching and more girls saying, I want to go do that. I want to play in the Olympics one day.
Well, we're all going to be behind you. We're all going to be watching, and I can't wait to see that speed off the blue line. Jocelyn Lamoureux-Davidson, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
And good luck in South Korea. That's Jocelyn Lamoureux-Davidson, forward for Team USA.
That was The Takeaway's Todd Zwillick. The Lamoureux sisters and Team USA will be back on the ice for a match with the Russian women on Tuesday. And on Thursday, their last preliminary round will be against Canada. Coming up on Main Street, a Cutting Ed podcast about educational innovation.
Giving to Prairie Public is as simple as sending a text. Just text the word SUPPORT to 484848 and set up the monthly deduction of your choice. $5, $10, $15, $20 a month? It's as simple as that. Here's the deal. You give what you can, and Prairie Public delivers reliable, fact-based journalism and outstanding top-shelf programs without commercial interruption or influence. Simple. So reach for your smartphone and text the word SUPPORT to 484848 and simply support Prairie Public today. And thanks.
NPR One is all about you. Handpicked public radio content based on what you like.
Who knew?
NPR One connects you to a stream of public radio news, stories, and podcasts curated especially for you.
NPR Hourly Newscasts, Prairie Public Regional News, it's all there.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh.
Download NPR One in the App Store now and select Prairie Public as your station.
For Prairie Public, I'm Dave Thompson.
A world of customized content delivered right to your smartphone.
Okay, guys, headphones on.
The story puts you in the center of the action.
It's on whenever you're on.
NPR One is all about you.
Download it today.
Prairie Public Education Services is hosting a series of free professional development workshops featuring area teachers, PBS resources, and best tech tips. Interactive sessions for every grade level and content area happening weekly. Join in person at the Prairie Public Station in Fargo or join virtually via webinar. Go to prairiepublic.education.org for more information and to sign up.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. State Senator Nicole Poolman represents District 7. She also teaches English at Century High School in Bismarck. She was a principal sponsor of the Education Innovation Bill passed during the last legislative session. Recently, she joined Tom Gerhart, host of the Cutting Ed podcast, to talk about educational innovations.
You're actually in the classroom. Let's talk about Senate Bill 2186 and how your background, actually being in the classroom, helped you in drafting that bill.
Well, it's important to give credit where credit is due. There were many educational leaders involved in drafting 2186. When I sat down with Superintendent Baszler to talk about the bill, one thing I was more concerned with was the administrative rule process when she would come up with the qualifying requirements in order to qualify for these waivers. One of my fears as a teacher was that we would see administrators and superintendents have a top-down reform that they wanted to impose upon teachers. And so one of the things that's very important to me, and we're still in the process of reviewing those rules, is to make sure that they have parental buy-in so that they have a certain amount of parents that have said, yes, we think this is a good idea and good for our kids and good for education. And even more importantly, from my perspective, a faculty buy-in as well. So both teachers and parents are going to have to come together and say, we think this is best for our kids before this is even approved.
We've heard the word innovative a lot in recent months. Teachers are already innovating in the classroom. Talk a little bit about maybe where we are and what may be different as to where we're headed.
I think it's such an important point to make. Innovation as a word seems to be a little bit overused. And when people, especially teachers, hear about this bill, I hope that they will hear that it really is a bill about flexibility and allowing teachers to finally say, what would I do if I could do anything? Because teachers every day in their classrooms are doing innovative things. I always say that if you haven't been in the classroom in 5 years, you haven't been in the classroom because it's constantly changing. Society is constantly changing, and even more importantly, our kids are constantly changing. Their minds are very different today than they were 20 years ago simply because they are constantly on those phones. And that is really fundamentally changing the way their brains work, and teachers are having to adapt. And this is just really opening the door to even more of that.
As the prime sponsor of Senate Bill 2186, what is your hope for the bill?
My hope for the bill is that we can finally cater education to certain students, to certain groups of students. I look at students with special needs, and I really see a lot of opportunities with this bill in terms of the flexibility it can provide to create programming that will prepare them for the future that awaits them. I'm hopeful that we will start to see academies, schools within schools. You know, I still hope that one of the high schools in Fargo will partner with Microsoft and create a tech academy within a school. Here at Century High School, we are talking about how can we cater our core classes to career and technical students. We know that we send a whole bunch of kids to Wahpeton. What is it that Wahpeton wants them to be able to do in terms of reading and writing and communicating that they don't do in a regular core class? And so that's one thing that we are looking at here at Century to really prepare the students for the futures that await them. And we know that those futures are very different for very different kids. And so I think that the flexibility this bill gives us will really allow us to individualize education for kids.
What will define success for you a year from now, 2 years from now, 5 years from now? I'm not sure when the right time frame is, but in the fairly near future.
I think success will be defined if we really have waived some of these rules. I mean, I do have a concern that maybe schools won't apply for this in nearly as many numbers as we hope. So success for me will be seeing the number of schools and school districts that apply for these waivers, because the waivers they apply for will look very different. We have small schools who are creating programs with internships for every senior in high school. Well, that can't work for a Century High School with 450 seniors. We can't find 450 internships in Bismarck. But that's going to be a great opportunity for those small schools. Here at Century, we're going to have different opportunities that we want to give to our students. And so I think success will be measured in the number of schools seeking this flexibility and the number of schools that are awarded it.
And that can build a base, right? I mean, 10 ideas in a year, 20 ideas in a year, that can be shared.
Absolutely. And hopefully they will share it statewide. What works for one small school could certainly work for another. What is happening on the East can certainly happen in the West. And so we do hope that as schools try new things, that other schools pay attention and that there's a lot of communication between districts.
You mentioned kids having smartphones. How has technology changed the way you teach?
As an English teacher, it has fundamentally changed the way my class looks every day. If you were to walk into my classroom 20 years ago, we would have been reading novels and discussing literature. They would have been writing papers with note cards and all sorts of notes and a pile of books. Today, the world has changed so much that not only are they learning through that technology, so they're writing their entire research paper on their Chromebooks, but even the content of what I teach has changed, because when they are constantly surrounded by information, a big part of my job now is teaching them how to navigate that information, how to decide if something is credible, how to decide where is the best place to get their information and their news. And so we really spend a lot of time now on teaching kids how to be learners, teaching kids how to navigate information, simply because they are inundated with it all day long.
For teachers, Senate Bill 2186 seems to be empowering. It seems like a pretty big deal.
It is a pretty big deal. And that's my one hesitation with 2186, is that I do worry that this becomes something that is a top down, that in its actual implementation, I worry that it will be superintendents telling teachers, this is my new idea and this is how we are going to reform. I really hope it doesn't go that way. I hope we start with teachers coming together in their professional learning communities, in their departments, and with parents and saying, how could we do better? We have this certain population of kids. How can we serve them better? And making a program that caters to the needs of that school and those kids. So that's, I think it can be really empowering for teachers, and I hope that it is. I hope that these ideas come from teachers and not administrators.
The bottom-up approach is excellent. We should mention, though, that from the top down, and this bill has enjoyed broad support. That's important for its success or potential success.
It has, on both sides of the aisle. You know, I think everybody realizes that with a constantly changing society, we need an education system that can adapt with that. And so whether you are conservative and you are looking to the business community and you want the kids to be ready to develop a strong workforce, or, you know, you consider yourself on the left side of the aisle and you want more creativity and innovation in the classroom, I think that that's why we see broad support. Everybody realizes and recognizes that with a constantly changing world, we have to have a constantly changing academic system to support it.
So it seems people are recognizing that this is all about kids, putting kids first and their future extremely important.
Absolutely. And if we can put kids first, truly put them first, and truly find what works best for certain populations of students and even individual students, I think that that's a winner for everyone.
I remember you said in a press conference that you were excited about several possibilities for teachers and students. We've covered a little bit of that ground, but can you explain a little bit more about what you were saying?
Well, like I said, I'm excited for all sorts of students. I'm excited for really bright students who need more of a challenge. I think that opening up some integration of learning. We still do a lot of our learning in isolation in our traditional public school system. Integration of those courses, you know, we hear about STEM education all the time. And so having integrated courses in science and technology and math, and not necessarily having to worry about dedicating 50 minutes each day to each one of those, that's a really empowering thing for kids who are bright and ready to really take off in the STEM fields. It's also really encouraging for a lot of our special needs students who we are dragging through a traditional curriculum that isn't necessarily beneficial to them. And so I would really like to see us cater programs to students with special needs where their learning is far more meaningful than it is right now.
Why is innovative education, in the terms we're defining, so important?
I think it's so important because the flexibility is necessary to provide the best education for each of our students. Not only is the system constantly changing, but each of our kids, they're constantly changing. And so we want to make sure that they are ready for the future that awaits them, the choices that they want to make. Superintendent Basler talks often about being choice ready. well, what does that look like and how do we get them there? I think more flexibility is key in order to get each child where they want to be in the future.
I wanted to ask you what advice you have for teachers, but especially new teachers.
My biggest piece of advice when we talk about any sort of new reforms or any innovation, my biggest piece of advice, especially to new teachers, would be don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. There is still a role for traditional education practices. And when we combine those with new and exciting and innovative things, that works very well. But when we abandon what we know works for something we are trying out, oftentimes we lose knowledge. An example would be in a local elementary school, I had talked to a parent whose child was doing project-based learning in science. Well, when the parent asked just basic questions about the science standards of that age group, the child couldn't answer any of those questions. Well, because they had totally abandoned any traditional education for this project. And so that would be my number one piece of advice. Make sure that you're still providing that traditional background and base and enhancing it with these innovative practices, because enhancing is important, but making sure we get the basics is critical as well.
Any advice for policymakers, lawmakers?
Well, I always think that lawmakers should have to take the same oath that doctors do. First, do no harm. That would be my advice to lawmakers. Many times they will have very well-meaning intentions, very good intentions. Well, we should do more suicide prevention training. We should do more mental health training. We should do more of this. Well, what they realize is that every time you add something for a teacher to learn, or every time you add something for a student to learn, something else goes by the wayside. And so I think that when we are making policy about education, we have to be thoughtful. We have to trust parents. We have to trust teachers and make sure that what we do is doing no harm.
If teachers have questions or wonder what to do next, what direction would you point them in?
Well, I would point them to their local principals. I think principals at the building level are all aware of this bill and the opportunities it provides. If that doesn't yield an answer for you, I would say you could probably call the Department of Public Instruction. But basically, in a nutshell, the bill is this. If you want to be able to break a rule that we have in terms of education in the state of North Dakota, and you have a good idea that's going to improve student learning and student outcomes, then let's talk. Let's see what it takes to be able to break that rule and implement some programs that are going to be exciting for kids and for teachers and hopefully for our future.
This question popped into my head when you were mentioning if you were in my classroom 20 years ago, what we would see. What about 20 years from now? And I'm asking you to really speculate, but do you think we could look back at this time as being a really critical juncture in our state history?
I do. I think even nationally, I think that 20 years from now, I think that they will laugh at the concept that we used to teach courses all in isolation. You know, that kids would move from math class to science class to English class.
The Cutting Ed Podcast is a collaboration with North Dakota United, Prairie Public, the North Dakota Department of Public Instruction, and philanthropist Ted Denter-Smith. Dakota Datebook is next.
When you hear arts programming here on Prairie Public, know that it is supported in part by the North Dakota Council on the Arts, and we thank them.
This is Dakota Datebook for February 12th. On this date in 1915, the Washburn Leader newspaper printed an extensive article about the state of child labor in North Dakota. The article summarized a presentation by Dr. J. M. Gillette of the University of North Dakota. Besides being a sociology professor, Gillette was chairman of North Dakota's Child Labor Committee and a member of the Advisory Committee on National Child Labor. At the time, child labor was widely accepted in both cities and rural areas. Children worked in agricultural jobs, factories, and mines. Gillette said that Congress had been considering the matter of child labor for the past 10 years, but had not addressed it in any comprehensive way. In 1910, almost 2 million children between the ages of 10 and 15 were working. This amounted to 1 out of every 6 children in the country. Almost half of them were under the age of 14. Gillette argued that not all work was bad for children. It was good for them to do chores and learn to be industrious. But he noted that child labor kept children out of school. Working children who tried to stay in school often dropped out when they fell behind in their classes and became discouraged. States with the highest rate of child labor also had the highest rates of illiteracy. Children who worked had higher rates of criminal arrest and were often repeat offenders. Children who worked unsupervised, such as newsboys and delivery boys, were the most likely to have criminal records. Children who worked had higher rates of disease and medical problems than those who did not. When President Franklin Roosevelt was campaigning for re-election, a young girl passed him a note. She said that she and other girls were working in a sewing factory for $5 a week. She pleaded for help. On June 25, 1938, Roosevelt signed the Fair Labor Standards Act. It set a minimum wage of 25 cents per hour and a maximum work week of 44 hours. It also banned child labor. Today, North Dakota imposes some additional restrictions on child labor that are intended to protect children from being taken advantage of and from performing dangerous jobs. The minimum age for employment is 14, and children 14 to 15 are prohibited from performing several types of jobs. A few examples are construction, door-to-door sales, and cooking. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from the North Dakota Humanities Council.
In the case of an incoming missile attack, the plan is for the feds to notify state authorities, but it is then up to municipal and county officials to issue an emergency alert. That's news to local officials across the country.
Military events are not something that we have within the scope of our responsibilities to alert for.
Whose job it should be to warn the public on the next morning edition.
That's tomorrow morning, right here on Prairie Public.
Tuesday on Main Street, horticulturist Ron Smith will join us with a discussion of flowers for that big holiday this week. That's Valentine's Day. And also on Tuesday, are children falling victim to intentionally addictive technology? We'll talk with Colby Zentel with Common Sense Media, which is advocating for more research into the developmental effects of technology on kids. We hope you can join us for Main Street on Tuesday. In the meantime, enjoy the rest of your day.